Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of February, Abraham Lincoln's birthday. Happy birthday to Abraham Lincoln. This hour of the program, this story, a lot of people are talking about this story. And if you use the web, if you have teenagers in your house, if you have young people in your house, there's a whole new world out there that is filled with images that are terrible. There's a whole world out there that I think that teens are involved in that we don't know a whole lot about. And this was all brought to mind. I'm not sure how prevalent this is, but this story has attracted actually national and international attention. It was in the New York Times yesterday, and it hails from New Berlin, Wisconsin, where an 18-year-old male student was accused of posing as a girl on Facebook and getting 31 classmates, at least 31, to send naked pictures of themselves to him and then blackmailing some of them for sex acts. He was charged with 5 counts of child enticement last week, 2 counts of second-degree sexual assault of a child, 2 counts of third-degree sexual assault, possession of child pornography, repeated sexual assault of the same child, and also making a bomb threat. So this hour of the program, we're going to be talking about how parents can keep their young people safe online, how young people keep themselves safe online, and then looking at the underlying aspect of this. Why is it that so many people would send naked pictures of themselves, and how widespread is this practice? We have 2 guests with us this hour, and I have a feeling we'll have a lot of phone calls on this as well. Our guests are Larry Magid. He is a technology analyst for CBS News and for CNET, and he is the author of MySpace, and that's Safe Online Networking for Your Kids. He's written actually a number of books. He's an internet safety advocate, founder of SafeKids.com, SafeTeens.com, and co-director of ConnectSafely.org, author of MySpace Unraveled, A Parent's Guide to Teen Social Networking, and then the Little PC book, and the list goes on and on. Larry, thank you very much for being with us. I know it was. I would think so, too. Happy birthday to both of them. Ironic that we're both born on the same day, right? Yeah, isn't that something? Quite a day in history. Right, yeah. Also joining us is Dr. Sharon Hirsch, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Chicago. And thank you so much, Dr. Hirsch, for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Let's just start with, I think a lot of us were flabbergasted when we heard this story for 2 reasons. Number one is that you can do this kind of thing on the internet, which seems to me relatively new as far as technology is concerned. Send naked pictures of yourself, get a lot of naked pictures, and worse than that, on the internet. And number two, why it is that so many young people would have engaged in this kind of behavior. Let's start with you, Larry. I think this is prevalent on the internet from having teenagers in the house and from talking to other parents about this. I think that this sharing of pictures and sometimes naked pictures is fairly widespread. Am I off the mark?
No, there are actually surveys that suggest you're very much on the mark. I don't know if I believe the number, but I saw one survey that said that like 1 out of 5 teens has sent or received a nude photo. So the idea of sharing nude photos is actually relatively common. This particular case, the idea that he used it in a very exploitive kind of way to essentially extort sex, I haven't heard many cases like this, but it's not uncommon for a boy and a girl to share these kind of intimate pictures. I guess my generation may have done that with Polaroids, although I don't think I did. I did other things, but not that. But certainly, this is happening quite a bit in our culture today.
It's not going out on the air.
Uh-huh. And why is it happening in our culture a lot now?
Well, that's a really interesting question. First of all, because it can. I mean, the fact that a cell phone can easily be used to take a picture and immediately translate it. And second of all, I think because sexuality has changed a bit since many of us adults were young, kids are much less privacy conscious in certain ways, and they're I guess, less vain in other ways. But it's really a complicated question. I mean, I would want to hear from a psychologist and other experts on childhood risk behavior. But the other is, I think kids don't perceive it as a
Oh.
Made the mistake of calling the cops instead of dealing with it as a parent might deal with it. The police intervened, arrested both kids, and charged them with felony child pornography.
Ooh. Right.
Child pornography crime, of course, designed to protect children who were exploited. These kids were technically, legally speaking, exploiting themselves, but they were still charged with child pornography. And, you know, that can be registered with a sex offender. So, regardless of any other risk, legally, you're putting yourself in a very dangerous position. And again, I'm not talking about this individual. I'm talking about the more innocent type of thing that you're referring to.
And tell me, why is it that young people don't know about the potential legal ramifications here, to say nothing of why you would sort of demean yourself in doing this? Why is it that young people would do this? Are they just ignorant, Dr. Hirsch?
Well, you have to remember, developmentally, young people at this age feel like they're invulnerable. Teenagers really don't understand that things that they do have those long-term implications, and that's pretty normal for this age group. They really turn towards their peers, and they don't want to listen to rules, listen to adults. They know those rules are out there, but it's not their prevailing culture. They really turn towards their peer group.
Mm-hmm. And the technology, I know that when I was a teenager, people would get Playboy magazines and things like that. Some of this material, it seems to me to be incredibly demeaning stuff. It's just nasty.
As far as kids go, they don't, you know, they're looking at pictures. They've got a lot of curiosity about sex. Things are much more available to them these days. And so they may put things out there innocently, just kind of exploring and trying to understand this, and then get caught up in something. And then they realize, uh-oh, I did something that's really going to not be so good. I got to try and cover it up. And I think that's where they may get in trouble if they don't feel like they can talk to parents, if they don't feel like they can really go to a trusted adult and say, what do I do now? Then you may lead to a situation where they are being abused. And that's clearly what happened to these children. Sexual abuse is very common, more common than we would like to believe in this country. And I think as parents, we may not be quite as good as picking up on it or being open to thinking that may be happening to our kids. And we've got to do a better job of that if we want to protect them.
And we just want to let Larry know that if you can go to a phone, Larry, we're having a little bit of a technical problem here. We're in new studios, and it doesn't seem to be working exactly. So if you could go to a phone right now so we can make sure we hear what you're saying. Yeah, we just need to have you go to a phone. Thank you very much. And we'll be welcoming phone calls from you as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We are aware of the fact that we're having problems, and we do want him to be able to hear. I'm sorry, we're having a few problems here. Dr. Hirsch, let me go back to you for a moment as we try to figure this out and ask you, why is it? Is it an insecurity? Is it common that so many, and maybe young girls would do this as well if the circumstances were different, would send naked pictures of themselves to a classmate? Why would you do something like that?
Well, I think you get into peer pressure. If all your friends are doing it, it becomes normative. You say, okay, well, you know, my boyfriend wants this, you know, and or whoever, and I'll just do that. They're proud of their bodies. They're driven by their what's going on in their peer group. But again, I want to emphasize that this is a form, can be a form of sexual abuse. And so we have to look even a little bit deeper and kind of see, is this something that's going on? Are they in a setup for sexual abuse? Have they been exploited like this before so that they're more vulnerable? I'm not saying that these kids were, but it's something I think as adults, as parents, we want to be aware of and really raise that question to make sure that we're protecting our kids.
Mm-hmm. And we left you in the middle. I would like for you to repeat, Larry. I'm not sure everybody heard what you were saying. We were having some technical difficulties here. And I'd like for you to please repeat what you were saying, which was very important, about what the legal ramifications can
All
be
right.
from some of this, and people are not aware of it.
Sure. Wouldn't you know the technology?
Oh, I know.
Technical problems.
Right.
Yeah. The problem is that possession and distribution of child of naked images like this is technically and legally child pornography. So you have cases where young people are innocently, not even this case where I think he had some pretty nasty motives, but where they're innocently sharing pictures of themselves. And they could actually and have been arrested and in some cases convicted of possession or distribution of child pornography. And there was a case in Florida where a 17-year-old boy, 16-year-old girl had pictures of themselves. The one sent it to the other person. The parent saw it on the computer, made the mistake, I think, of calling the police. The police did what police do. They wrote it up as a crime. It turned out that it was a felony. They were convicted, and these kids have a record of child pornography and maybe have to register as sex offenders. And all it was two young people who had a relationship that were sharing intimate moments. And, you know, had I been the parent, I would have had a very strong conversation with my kids. But by bringing the police in, and because of the legal system, and of course, there are very good reasons why we have child pornography laws. It protects, in some cases, infants from being sexually exploited in very base ways. But I don't think the child pornography laws were ever intended. I don't think anybody envisioned that this kind of activity would take place and that would fit under the legal rubric. So regardless of any other social or emotional or even moral issues,
right,
just the legal issue alone,
right,
it could be devastating to a young person.
Right. And Dr. Hirsch, I don't think many young people know that, and there are a lot of parents who are technically not savvy enough to know that this kind of thing is going on.
As far as sharing the pictures?
Right, as far as sharing, and even right, knowing that all this material is out there.
You know, we want to trust our kids. We want to think
sure,
they're innocent. It's hard for us to see our children growing up and imagine that they are sexually active human beings. And it's very a difficult transition for a lot of parents to make, but we've got to be able to do that. We've got to leave that door open, even if our kids say, no, I don't want to talk to you, Mom. No, not about sex. You have to make sure that they understand that they can do that anytime, anywhere, no questions asked, because otherwise they're not going to get accurate information. And as Larry said, they may end up in a lot more trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the interesting about these stories is that when you look at the so-called perpetrators and the so-called victims, they're almost always about the same age.
Hmm.
That this is really about it's teenage behavior, and I'm sure the doctor can explain better than I can about teenage risk-taking and the fact that the brain doesn't develop fully until you're 25 years old. But this is really risk-taking, and you asked me earlier, and I don't know if it came on the air, about, you know, some of the reasons why they would do that besides the fact that they can.
Mm-hmm.
I think another reason is that for most kids, they don't experience negative consequences. So there's this notion of high-frequency, low-risk behavior. Now, I think there are risks associated with sharing naked pictures besides just illegal. But if you've done it a number of times and nothing bad has happened, then the message comes back to you, well, this isn't such a bad thing. And it's the same issue of dealing with drug use and other areas where some authorities or adults say it's bad, but the kids experience it and they still get good grades and they get into college and they have normal relationships. So again, we need to look at this, not necessarily something we want to condone, but something we just sort of need to understand in the context of youth behavior.
Right. And Dr. Hirsch, what about having normal relationships, normal sexual relationships, if you are have a lot of this going on, if you're sharing naked pictures, if you're taking in pornography on your computer? Do you run a risk of not being able to either of having sex too early in your life or not, or having the wrong view of what sexuality is or could be?
Well, I think certainly when you start getting used as a sexual object, it creates a different kind of sexual life for the person,
mm-hmm,
than having an intimate relationship. And you certainly run the risk of not being able to become intimate and have those deep relationships. Different people different people react differently to these kind of abusive relationships and exploitation. Some people will be strong enough and have enough resiliency, have enough supports, that they will come out basically kind of unscathed. But over 60% of teenagers, kids who are sexually abused, and again, this is a kind of sexual abuse, will end up having some significant psychiatric pathology and being diagnosed with psychiatric illness that needs treatment.
Hmm.
I just want to point out, I may have said this when I was, I'm not sure I was on the air earlier.
Yeah.
But this is a relatively rare case of exploitation, that if you really look at the totality of this, it may not be smart, but it's fairly innocent. So we need to make sure that when we look at this case, we don't think that the outlying case is the norm. I haven't heard of that many cases where young people have essentially extorted, used this as a form of extortion or coercion. Obviously, it happened in this case. It can happen. But we shouldn't be thinking, because this is happening, that every child is doing that, or every child that exchanged a nude picture
right.
is in danger of sexual exploitation.
Right.
Right, but I think any time you put a nude picture out on the web, you do run the risk of that showing up on a child porn
mm-hmm.
website, coming back to haunt you in a job application later on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, maybe it's not all that widespread. I was amazed, though, and a lot of people have been, Dr. Hirsch, by the number of young males who responded to this and then were sexually blackmailed, I guess because they didn't want their pictures to be made public. Or tell us the other part of the story here. We're talking about 31, and reports are that it may be greater than that, perhaps much greater than that. That's a lot of young people who responded the way they did and were willing to give sex to this guy.
Right. I mean, I'm not an expert on blackmail, but certainly when you've got a fear that something's going to happen and you see maybe not with the best judgment that you could get out of that, it sounds like they were taking that path of least resistance. And again, I think if you'd had parents that they felt like they could talk to, or felt that there really would have been some protection for them, that these pictures wouldn't have been published and they wouldn't have been embarrassed, maybe they would have felt more comfortable taking that path. I can't explain why they didn't do that. You know, I think we'd have to look at each case individually.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the parents finding this video or pictures on of their teenager and his or her girlfriend having sex, and there it was on the internet. And they alerted the police. What would have been a better course of action, Larry?
Well, I think, first of all, had the police responded the way I wish they would have, it could have been a good course of action. In the best of all worlds, I would like to see police being able to deal with these in a much more sympathetic and non-legalistic manner. But given the fact that in many cases police simply go by the book, and the book is written in ways that can be pretty harsh, I think it would have been better had they, first of all, sat down with the kids, had each parent sat down with theirs and explained to the kids why this is a risk. Just as Dr. Hirsch said, they can get into the wrong hands. Today's girlfriend can become tomorrow's ex-girlfriend. She may be angry. There's the possibility of revenge. She might go ahead and post it on the internet. Again, perhaps they're very much in love and that would never happen, but we all know that that very much can happen. And any digital image, anything that's digital, can be so easily reproduced and reposted. Another thing is, you post something on your Facebook profile that's only available to a handful of your friends, and you think it's going to stay that way. Well, anybody who's taken a rudimentary, you don't even take a class, who knows anything about computers, knows you can right-click on an image, copy the image, and presto, put it anywhere you want. And that's the problem with digital images. In the old days of Polaroids, it would have been much more difficult, not impossible, but much more difficult for somebody to distribute that image beyond just themselves or
right.
a handful of friends.
Yeah. Let's take some phone calls. I think we'll have many on this. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about this case that has received a lot of national and international attention, actually, out of New Berlin, Wisconsin, with an 18-year-old male student who has been charged with 5 counts of child enticement, 2 counts of secondary sexual assault of a child, 2 counts of third-degree sexual assault, possession of child pornography, repeated sexual assault of the same child, and making a bomb threat. He posed as a girl on Facebook, tricked at least 31 of his male classmates to send him naked photos of themselves, and then blackmailed some of them for sex acts. So there are a lot of issues here. You know, there are a lot. It brings to mind a lot of issues. We're talking about them. Larry is technology analyst for CBS News and CNET, author of a number of books, including MySpace, Safe Online Networking for Your Kids. Dr. Sharon Hirsch is assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Chicago. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right. We start taking your phone calls. Joe from Wausau. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
I would just like to mention a simple way that all parents can protect their children. I guess we have kind of a confusion of what computers are. A decade ago, computers were toys. You played video games on them and did homework on them. Well, now they're connected to the Internet. And the Internet is a lawless expansion of virtual space. And we need to treat it like they're out in public. So I think parents should be placing the computer in a public space, like the family room. If you only have one computer, or maybe two computers if you need them, if they're both in a public space where people are constantly walking through, things like this won't happen, and you can keep a closer eye on what your children are doing without actually, you know, going in and looking at their private information, but they still have to be in public to be on the computer. And I think it's the mixture of public into a private space that kind of allows these private, intimate moments to break out into public. And I don't know, that's just a simple thing that I think every parent who is listening to this who has a computer in their child's bedroom needs to remove it and put it in the family room.
All right, thanks, Joe, for the call. Larry, you want to respond first?
Yeah, I've given a lot of thought to that. In fact, I wrote that kind of rule many years ago that always put the computer in a public space. The problem is that the environment's changed dramatically since I wrote that 10 years ago for two reasons. Number one, the cell phone is a computer, and it's not used in a private, it's a public, it's used anywhere. And in fact, I didn't follow the story detail, but I imagine these were probably cell phone pictures that were taken. And number two, the laptop and the Wi-Fi. When my kids were young, absolutely, they had no computers in their bedrooms. The computers were in a family area, and mom and dad could walk in the room any time. But today's kids often have notebook computers with wireless Wi-Fi connections that they can take anywhere. And again, even if you don't have that, the cell phone is another device. So I think that while that's good advice, the most important advice is that you speak with your teens often. Mechanistic tools to control teenage behavior generally don't work, whether it's filters, whether it's a rule like computer in the public space. If a young person is going to abuse their technology, they're going to do it, and you're not going to stop them by doing something mechanistic. You really need to work with your kid, starting at a very young age. I'm sure Dr. Hirsch, again, knows far more than I do about childhood development, but starting at a very young age, you need to work with your kids and try to get the filter between their ears to be functioning. Because, again, filters or moving computers in public areas, yeah, good idea, but it's not going to solve the problem.
Well, Dr. Hirsch, what do you think?
Larry, I think you're pretty wise on this, and I'm not sure I can add a whole lot more to that. But certainly helping kids understand that this is a dangerous environment. It's just like you don't go accept candy from a stranger so they can snatch you and put you in the car. You don't know who's out there on the Internet and what they may be trying to get you to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm so concerned about all this stuff that it's really offensive to me just as a human being that all of this is out there and it's so easy to access. I don't understand that. I don't know how people get through with these images. I don't know how young people get some of them. I just don't know why it's there. Maybe I'm naive about this, but why is all of that there and so easily accessible?
Because people want to put it there. I mean, it's just, you know, the Internet is just so open, and there are no rules. And countries that have tried to impose rules have either done so because they can, because they're essentially dictatorships, and even they haven't been successful. And to the extent that we've tried to control it in the U.S., it's gone up against very strongly argued constitutional issues, and the Supreme Court has ruled against trying to suppress the Internet because as much as we talk about dangers and bad things, they represent a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a percent of the entire Internet. I mean, this is the margins that we're talking about relative to all of the things that are online and all the good things that we and young people do online. So it's just part of life. But, you know, I remember taking my kids to Times Square back in the late 80s before Giuliani cleaned it up. And I was taking them to a theater, a very respectable, wonderful show, and we had to walk by some porn theaters, and we encountered people on the street who didn't look too savory. But, you know, the reality was that my kids were, first of all, with us because they were young, but number two, knew what to do. They knew not to engage with certain people on the street. They knew not to go into a porn theater. And we managed to have a very nice day in Times Square, despite the fact that there was a lot of junk around us.
Let's go next time. Phone lines are open now if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655. Paul from New Berlin. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks. I'm the obvious fascination youth have with their developing bodies and relationships along the sexual lines. That's going to be a given. My concern Well, I'm running for school board and for mayor of New Berlin here right now. And last time I ran, I proposed a community center to provide activities for the youth to divert their minds and engage them in meaningful activities that would help develop them for a better future and help work with the community. My concern is that our educational process does not provide the academic skills in a context that really makes them relevant to the development of the child, and so that the kids can really feel like they're preparing themselves for a better a life in a world that has hope for them. And so they don't have to digress in these types of activities. So I'm hoping that what we can do is develop programs that in communities that enlist mentors for junior achievement programs that, you know, for developing business models, for programs for understand kids to understand these issues, discuss them amongst themselves, and generally create a context for community that is more wholesome and doesn't, you know, mm-hmm. create these problems. Mm-hmm. At any rate, the election is next Tuesday.
Okay, and we can't do a lot of electioneering here, but Dr. Hirsch, you want to respond?
I think certainly if we want, you know, one of the tenets of any kind of parenting is to, you know, have rewards for positive behavior, and certainly getting them out to play basketball or whatever it is that you like to do and doing that with you is a positive reward. Doing negatives if they're doing things you don't like, taking away their computer time, taking away other things is important. But I think what we have to understand is that sex has been around for centuries, for millennia. It's not going away, and teenagers are going to be interested in it. And I think we just have to help them to navigate that in a very, very thoughtful way so that they can understand what's safe and what's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also part of this larger problem in this society, isn't it, Sharon and Larry? And that's that this is a huge, pornography stuff is a huge multi-billion-dollar business in this country. We could do several shows on that. What's that all about?
Well, obviously, there's a big demand for it, and you know, it's been around a long time. But I have to agree that today's pornography is different than your father's Playboy.
Right.
And the problem that I have with it, and the discussion I had with my 14-year-old when I found that he'd been looking at some internet porn, was not that he was looking at pictures of naked women. That's sort of developmentally normal for a 14-year-old boy. It was that some of the pictures he was finding depicted acts that were non-consensual and violent, and it was
right.
a fusion of sex and violence.
Right.
And what I said to him, well, no, I didn't say it to him, but I'll say to you, largely, is that it's one thing for a 14-year-old to fantasize having sex, whether it's a woman or a man, whatever, because ultimately, probably they'll do that later in life, and for most of us, it works out pretty well when it's age-appropriate. But if you're fantasizing doing something that's non-consensual or violent or particularly unhealthy, then, and again, Dr. Hirsch is the psychiatrist, but it strikes me that seeing lots and lots of that mm-hmm. stuff is mm-hmm. one thing to occasionally see it, but if you're looking at it for a long period of time, I can't imagine that that's good for your sexual development.
Right. And Dr. Hirsch, you've talked about this.
I think certainly the studies have shown that when you see violent acts, you become desensitized to those acts, and you're more likely to commit those acts. And I don't think there's any doubt about that research. And clearly, there's much more violence of all kinds on the media today.
Right. Dan is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry, Dr. Hirsch. Hey, my daughter is 13, 7th grade. All of her friends text message, and we've been holding off. And we kind of hung a carrot out there and said, you know, if you get honor roll, if you get good grades, well, I'll be darned she doesn't come home with honor roll. And we're very proud of her. And now, you know, it's kind of forcing us into, you know, being true to our word. You know, are we really going to do text messaging? My wife saw a seminar at the Oconomowoc High School about all the dangers of the text messaging. And my question to you is, are there parental controls that you're aware of? You know, we use the phone line Sprint, and they have nothing, no parental controls whatsoever on text messaging for kids. Besides just flat-out denying them, have you heard or seen of anything that us parents can be aware of out there that can help us down that road?
Larry, you want to start?
They love it. It's fun. It's exciting. All their friends do it. So the peer pressure is enormous for them to want it. And I understand why they want it, but I still need to protect them.
Okay. Can I address
Please.
That?
Please. Sure.
Okay, well, first of all, again, we have to put this into context, that there are millions and millions of children doing text messaging, just as there are millions and millions of children on the Internet. And, you know, our kids are doing pretty well. I mean, in general, we have a generation that we're raising that seems to be pretty healthy. So I don't think we should panic about any of this. As per your question, I know that AT&T and Sprint are working on parental controls. AT&T has some content controls out there that can limit what you can do on the website. I think that the controls on cell phones are not as developed as they are on the fixed Internet. There's all sorts of filtering and monitoring software you can get for PCs. We're in the early stages of that developing in terms of the mobile. Now, if you go to my nonprofit website, connectsafely.org, you will see a section on mobile behavior. We worked with the CTIA, which is the Telecommunications Industry Association, to develop a number of tips and pointers, and you definitely should speak to your carrier. Obviously, you want to talk to AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint to see what they offer. But I think, again, it gets back to the filter that runs between the kids' ears. First of all, you have to figure out a pricing plan so that your young person doesn't break you on your text messaging.
Right.
And
the good news, through
there
that.
Are unlimited plans. Yeah. You also need to make sure she's not texting in inappropriate times and places, like class or dinner, although a lot of adults are playing with their BlackBerries in inappropriate times, so you might want to make sure you're a good role model. But then again, discuss with her text messaging. The issue with text messaging really is just that she may get cyberbullied. We worry about bullying via text messaging. This ability to transmit photos is something that we need to be aware of. You could consider getting her a phone without a camera, or a limited program on the camera, although she'll be screaming at you if you did that.
Right.
But again, it sounds to me from your description of your daughter that you've got a responsive, responsible daughter, and I'm betting that some good conversations frequently repeated at the dinner table are probably going to do the trick.
Hmm. Right on.
All right. Thanks very much. There is so much to be concerned about here, Dr. Hirsch. I mean, for heaven's sake, I didn't even think about the dangers of text messaging. Oh, man, it's one thing after another after another.
But really, these are all versions of what has gone on for decades and eons. It used to be journaling. It used to be passing notes. People would spend hours on the phone, or they'd go over to people's houses. And I think we just need to use the same skills that we have always used, which is communication and helping people grow up in a way that we find appropriate so that they'll know how to handle these situations, because these situations are going to come up.
Sure.
Doctor, I want to empathize with what Dr. Hirsch said. If you look at my generation, we survived the Vietnam War, we survived the drug culture, we survived the sexual revolution. My parents were absolutely scared to death. I remember looking at Time magazine covers about the generation, the baby boomers, and how terrible we turn out. And, for the most part, we've done pretty well. And I think that if you look at today's youth, again, I raised two digital kids. They're now in their early 20s, and I know a lot of their friends. And I'm looking at they've been on Facebook, they've been on instant messaging, and I can think of like 10 good things for every bad thing. I can think of the fact.
Oh, that's good.
That my 24-year-old daughter is still in touch with her high school friends, even though they went far and wide during college, because they kept in touch through instant messaging and Facebook and technology. So this is mostly a good thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm so glad to hear that. Give me the website, yours again, connectsafely.com.
.org.
ConnectSafely.org.
.com will get you there, too, but we're a nonprofit.
Okay. And what do we find there?
Well, you'll find a lot of tips for parents on social networking. We really focus on social networking.
Great.
And focus on teens. Just a lot of tips and discussions like we're having today, as well as a daily news feed about what's going on in technology and families.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Dan, for your call. Josh is next. Couple lines open, 800-486-8655. Josh from Viroqua. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering with the whole picture and text message thing, too, because with that, you can do videos now, and it seems like just about every teenager has a cell phone. And it's just, it's not like, even if your kid didn't have a camera on his phone, they can still receive them.
Right.
So that's where anybody could pretty much send anything they want to anyone then, that way. So you could get anything incoming. So I just was wondering about protecting that way too.
Larry?
Well, you can limit. You can again, you'd have to talk to your carrier, but I believe you can turn off the ability to download images. You can control just about anything. And remember, ultimately, you can even take away the cell phone or get a plan that limits them to only making calls to home for emergency purposes. You have a lot of controls. But, you know, I'm not so much worried about what kids see. I mean, look, if a kid's going to see an image of a naked person, chances are they're going to see it sooner or later. I'm much more worried about what they send, what they say. That's what tends to get you in trouble, especially among teenagers. I think that you talked earlier about this age of innocence or this myth of innocence. The reality is that kids are pretty savvy. If there's stuff that nauseates them, they're not going to look at it for the most part. But there's just so much we can do to protect our kids, again, using tools versus just having conversations with them and making sure they're comfortable in their own skin, that they feel good about talking to you, that they know that they can come to you with a problem and your first reaction isn't going to be to yank the computer and take away the cell phone. And also, if they have a good peer group, it turns out that peer support is often the way we deal best with cyberbullying. Sometimes fellow teenagers are better equipped to help kids deal with cyberbullying than adults, counselors, and parents. So it really has to do with the environment. And it also turns out, and I'll shut up in a second, that when you look at kids that engage in high-risk behavior online, and again, I don't know about this New Berlin case, but in general, these are kids that engage in high-risk behavior offline. Rarely does it suddenly pop up, oh, my God, my kid did something terribly dangerous on the Internet, without something, some clue, whether it's alcohol, drug use, family problems, depression. Usually there's some connection between real-world issues and online risk-taking.
Would you address, thanks very much for the call, Josh. Would you address that as well, Dr. Hirsch?
Certainly. I think that there are, this case, and I don't know this young boy or teenager, but certainly it sounds like he has some significant underlying issues. He's intimidating people, he's bullying them, he's making threats. Those kinds of issues will get you a psychiatric diagnosis of conduct disorder, and if you're an adult, a possible sociopath. And so those are things that we take very seriously. We know can have serious consequences. And so you do need to look for those things. I think also the thing to look for is what's going on with these kids that are being bullied. And they've got to have some change in their behavior. And I would hope that parents would be alert to that, be able to pick up on changes in grades, changes in withdrawal in these kids, and making sure that you know what's going on with your kids. If they're not home, where are they? What are they doing? That's really important to know.
Sure, yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Samaya. Is it Samaya from Milwaukee? Hello, are you there? Okay, let's go to Brad from Oshkosh. Hi, Brad.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Just a comment on something that one of your guests just said a minute ago. As far as noticing, it's usually not just, you know, these children, oh, my God, you see the one thing. It's usually a system of things that's happening. Regardless, we still need to hold the children accountable. But at one point, you know, there's laws, certain laws that are out there for if an underage child does something wrong, the parents are usually held accountable. But you're not really hearing about it too much with the computers and the new technology as far as holding the parents accountable and actually, you know, and putting them up to the fire, saying, what are you doing? You know, a lot of parents in my generation, I'm 30, I have a 5-year-old and a 6-month-old, and I worry about even just having a cell phone. I mean, because you can't follow them, you know, 24/7. But yet, jamming the, you know, don't do this, don't do that down their throat seems to push them to do more. The accountability seems to be far gone, and you know, as diagnosing things for children, ADD and all this other stuff. When I was raised, you did something wrong, you got punished. You know, there's no really accountability anymore for the parents and what they're doing right or wrong with their children anymore. And I'll take a comment.
Okay. All right, thanks. Dr. Hirsch, you want to start?
Well, I think certainly parents are held responsible if your kids are truant from school. You know, if kids are out there causing problems, they're going to set up programs with the parents through the courts so that they can help the kid. And that's really what we try and do with children or teenagers, that we try to rehabilitate them rather than sentencing them to jail for the rest of their lives. But I'm not a legal expert. I don't know of anything other than truancy that parents are actually sent to jail or held specifically responsible for what their kids do. psychiatric disorders are not changing in prevalence. I think we're getting better at diagnosing them, better at understanding them, and since we can treat them, people are talking about them more. They were around before in my generation, your generation, but, you know, if you don't have a lot of treatment and you're embarrassed by them, you don't talk about them.
Mm-hmm. Larry?
Dr. Hirsch mentioned that psychiatric disorders are not increasing in prevalence. One thing that might surprise people is that sexual abuse against children has actually declined in the last 14, 15 years. It's gone down 51% between 1990
really?
And 2004. I'm not suggesting the Internet has anything to do with that, but during the very time when the Internet came online and became popular, there was a decline in sexual abuse. So it's not as if the Internet suddenly has unleashed this horrendous series of crimes against children. It's actually down, not up. Again, I don't think there's any correlation, but we need to look at real numbers. If there are people who make a living out of doing serious research, don't pay attention to sound bites or politicians. No disrespect for politicians, but I'm actually just was on a task force where which was appointed by 49 of the state attorney generals, where we were looking at technology and predation. And we came out with a very, very well-researched report out of Harvard basically showing that the risk of being assaulted by an adult online is very, very low. And what did the attorneys general who commissioned the report do? They immediately discredited our research, said that we were basing it on faulty data, and that they're just fighting us because politically it makes a lot more – it's a lot more sexy to politically talk about predators and dangers and bad guys. Damn the research, you know, that there's actually data that suggests – that the biggest risk is cyberbullying and things that kids do to kids, which is indeed the very case we're talking about in Berlin, which is kid-on-kid exploitation. That's where the risk is, not the 40-year-old adult exploiting the 12-year-old girl. I mean, it happens, but it happens very, very rarely.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number, and a couple lines are open. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to your phone calls. Cornelia is next from Wauwatosa. Hi, Cornelia.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm very interested in this program because I have a 14-year-old daughter who is a very good student, very responsible girl. I can't complain about her. But this Facebook use has really gotten out of hand. And we've tried to work out a deal with her that's for 1 hour at a certain time. And we have the computer in a common area. And my question is, my daughter seems to think that we need to respect her privacy when she is on Facebook or emailing. And, you know, sometimes she leaves it sitting open. And I say, I don't think so. I don't believe that. And so, you know, I've seen a few things when she had it sitting open where I said, you know, I saw something here I really want to talk to you about.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that I have also warned her, and I have told this to her friends too, that I heard in one of your programs, actually, that prospective employers look into these Facebooks of people before they hire people and to try to get more of a picture about prospective employees. So is there anything you can say about that?
Yeah, that's a good area. Larry, you want to take that first?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, the privacy issue, that goes way back, and it goes back to telephone calls and how you decide how much privacy to give your young person, and that has to be on a case-by-case basis. I do think that young people, teenagers, do need a certain amount of privacy, but whether they've earned that right or not is really up to the parent. I would urge you to be careful in both directions, not over peer. I mean, not stand over the shoulder all the time, but also be
right.
aware. And that's just a delicate situation. There was another question she asked about
Facebook.
Employee. Yeah, it's true. Employers do and can, as well as college admission counselors, look at your Facebook profile, and it is absolutely true that what you publish on there could come back to haunt you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, if they see a young person doing something that's maybe technically a little racy but age appropriate, they're probably not going to deny you college admission. But I know of cases where, I know, for example, a case at UCLA where a resident assistant was fired because he was seen drinking in his dorm room on Facebook. Now, I'm sure he's not the first person to ever drink in a dorm room, but being indiscreet enough to put it on his Facebook, the authorities had no choice but to fire him because he basically flaunted it. So, yeah, you want to be careful.
Yeah.
When I think talking about privacy for your teenagers, you have to trust them. You have to help them earn that independence. But that doesn't mean you don't know what's going on with them. And if they leave something open, you talk with them about it. If they don't feel like talking about it, say, okay, well, you know, when you can talk with me about it, then you can have your computer time back and just walk away and leave it alone. They're going to get upset. But you have to set some limits, and you're the parent. You're in charge.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Cornelia, so much for your call. We go to Joy from West Bend next. Hi, Joy.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about a program that I'm involved in at my church. I go to a Unitarian Universalist church. We have a curriculum called OWL, Our Whole Lives. It's about sexuality. I'm a teacher for the middle schoolers. We have a program for middle schoolers, and then there's a separate session that's usually given to adults, like mostly their parents. I like to start out the program by saying that there's probably not a person in our country, maybe not in our world, that is totally rational about their sexuality, and we are trying to promote discussion about this to move in a healthy direction. We have a very comprehensive program that covers masturbation, abortion, homosexuality, sexual abuse, all the hot topics. We take a field trip to show the students how easy it is to go buy condoms. And we talk a lot about communication, respect, safety, and what is healthy. And yet, I know there is tremendous, tremendous peer pressure. So I think any parents that are not talking to their young people about what's going on out there, they're missing a chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know you have an excellent program at the Unitarian Church. Thank you very much for the call, Joy. Dr. Hirsch, you want to respond first?
I think certainly that it's easy to say, go talk to your kids about sex, having just had to have that talk with my 11-year-old. Mm-hmm. It's not quite so easy to do when it's your kid. So whatever you can do to help parents be able to do that, I think, is really important. And certainly different cultures have different sexual norms and comfort with talking about those things. But
right.
I think making sure that you bring kids up and explore the topic as it's appropriate for you is very important.
Mm-hmm. There's a good book for somebody to do, How I Talk to My Child About Sex. Maybe we can all learn from each other, right? It really is. We could use such a book. Larry, you want to respond?
Well, I remember when I was, I think, 12 years old, my dad gave me a book like that and said, here, read it. And
yeah.
He was too chicken to give me the talk.
Right.
I think that it's great that the church is doing that. I think, you know, that it's a trite expression. It takes a village, but it really does. It takes education in the schools, it takes church, it takes law enforcement to be reinforcing all sorts of messages. And I think that what the caller was really saying is it's about, largely about teenage sexuality and not so much about the Internet, because the Internet is simply where teenagers are going to explore their sexuality, and that's because that's what's out there. And the big difference, of course, between the Internet and all of the ways that we could have explored it in the past is that it's two-way, is that you're not just downloading information, i.e. reading Playboy magazine or looking at inappropriate material or maybe appropriate material. You could be uploading it as well. And so that's really the big change, is how you behave online, mm-hmm. what risks you're willing to take. And, of course, I'm sure, as Dr. Hirsch would agree, you can't and shouldn't eliminate all risk-taking in childhood. Risk-taking is part of development. It's part of what they learn. The question is to take appropriate risks and risks that are reasonable relative to their consequences and the developmental, the age and
right.
developmental cycle of the child.
Right.
I think we want exploration and we want to protect from risk as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both so much for being with us. Can you give us a website? I know you gave us one. Is there anything that we should go to learn more about all of this?
Well, again, connectsafely.org is where I'd love people to go, and also safekids.com if you have younger kids. And I'm not sure, or the sites that I operate.
Wonderful.
If you think your kids have been sexually abused or you're worried about trauma, National Child Traumatic Stress Network is a great place, okay. NCTSN.org.
Say that again, please.
NCTSN, National Child Traumatic Stress Network.
Okay. Thank you both so much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Sharon Hirsch, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Chicago. Larry Magid is a technology analyst for CBS News and CNET, author of a number of books, including MySpace, Safe Online Networking for Your Kids. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Rob Schroeder for producing this program. Once again, happy birthday to Abraham Lincoln, 200 years. And we're trying to plan a special event around that. We'll let you know about that next week. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I'll be with you again on Monday for All Things Political. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.